The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I have skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. We take a ride in another Martin Scorsese picture starring Robert De Niro, as we're talking to you about the 1976 Taxi Driver this week for Zach on Film.
Hey, Zach.
Hey, Steven.
Giving you some pretty intense action this week.
Yeah, man, this is
with a Taxi Driver.
Kind of a mind trip.
Yeah, you think?
A little bit. I mean, it's all over on the emotional scale.
So for those people who have never seen Taxi Driver before, give us a rundown.
So Taxi Driver, his main character, his name is Trevor, and he is a war vet, and he is now living in New York City, and he becomes a taxi driver.
Travis.
Yeah.
Travis, what did I say?
Yeah,
Trevor?
Travis. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Travis.
Travis.
There you go. Just T word.
Why is he a taxi driver?
Because he's just up all night to get lucky. Daft Punk song. Bam. Reference.
Okay.
Yep. So he's up all night, and he just wants to get around town, make some money.
I don't know if it's make money.
He's going to be up all night anyway, he said. So
yeah, right. He's going to be up all night anyway.
Up anyway. He might as well get paid.
Yeah, and I don't think, I mean, it's pretty clear that this is his only job. Being the taxi driver is his only job.
That's it.
And I don't know, that he's got some real problems.
Yes, he does.
What are the problems that pop up with poor Travis?
Well, I don't think it is ever explicitly says it, but there certainly seems to be some post-traumatic stress disorder going through Travis, which leads to, I think, to some forms of depression and social anxiety, and then ends up manifesting in... outbursts of really some dark anger,
you know,
even at the very end, but even in the middle throughout, kind of,
you know, we would have years ago. Well, today, I mean, we look at something like what's going on with Travis and we would have said, yes, that is PTSD. That's post-traumatic stress syndrome. He's exhibiting all of these things, but I don't think people really recognize that until, I mean, it was around, you call it the shell shock. After World War II. Yeah. But, you know, it wasn't
fatigue.
Yeah, battle fatigue. Maybe mid-80s is where it really started to gain popularity. So, you know, for a movie like this to kind of hint at the fact that Travis didn't deal well or wasn't able to cope with the things that happened in Vietnam, shape him. And then, of course, I don't know, he is racially motivated.
Yeah.
He is... you know, gender oriented as far as where he believes people's place should be, you know, gender equality.
Mm-hmm.
What else? Racist, sexist.
I don't know that he's racist so much as he doesn't trust anyone. And the people that he trusts the least are the people that are different. There are a couple of points in the movie where he reacts poorly to people who are of different races, who are also clearly acting, you know, crazy and or you know, intentionally over the top.
You know, I think at one point he does rattle off a bunch of racial slurs and says, "I got no problem with those people."
Yeah.
They're asking, and, you know, "I'll drive uptown, I'll drive downtown, give me this area, give me this area, I'll drive some of that, I don't care."
Right.
He has no connections with his fellow humans to the point where he doesn't understand that not everybody wants to hang out in a CD porno movie on a first date.
Yeah, Zach, right. Is that the first thing you did with your fiance was take her to go see a porno?
It was on the list, but unfortunately we don't have
those. I don't think there are porno theaters anymore.
Yeah. I remember when
certainly
I lived in
not
Atlanta.
In Western Kansas.
I remember in the Lion's Den, didn't they have little video booths? I don't know.
I have no idea.
So when I was in Atlanta in the early 90s, right in the heart of Buckhead, which is kind of the party bar kind of area, there was still an adult theater there until probably about 98. It went out of business, and it was out of business for a year.
Because of the internet.
It may have been, but internet speeds were pretty slow. And then a year later, it turned into a nightclub. Hmm. They gutted it and burned the insides, scrubbed it down with bleach, and then turned it into a nightclub. But you'd see businessmen go in every day at lunchtime, come out afterwards. So I'm sure they're still around. And what you're seeing here is real interesting too, because you're seeing a Times Square before.
That doesn't exist
Mayor
anymore.
Ed walked in and cleaned up the place, which I find fascinating.
42nd Street. Yeah, I love the presence of New York and the backgrounds and the people and the storefronts and the streets in this movie. This is one of those movies where you really have an incredibly strong sense of place, even before Travis starts telling you how much he hates the stink and the garbage and the slime. Those first scenes you can see, oh my God, this is just oppressive and scary and overwhelming and full of weird stuff.
You read The Watchmen, right? Mm-hmm. And you read Rorschach's character. And Rorschach is gotta be a Travis Bickle, clone or something.
Oh, there's definitely an influence.
Yeah.
Because his take
He's
on
an
the city
for sure.
Oh yeah. His take on the city is just the city is garbage. Yeah, it stinks. Thing. You know, some flood of biblical proportions needs to come in and wipe out this place. Mm-hmm. And Travis is the same way. And interestingly, I guess during the production, the filming of Taxi Driver, there was a garbage strike. Mm-hmm. And so the streets really were gross and disgusting and really smelly in the summertime.
And in the 70s, they had those moments where I swear to you, half the time when you see the pimps and the prostitutes and the weirdos in the background, I'm not entirely sure those are paid extras. I think that's De Niro driving down what I hope isn't, but probably is just a street. Because you see these characters in the background who just kind of have this terrifying life of their own with the platform shoes and everything. It's creepy.
Rodrigo, what'd you think of this depiction of Travis and New York of the time period?
I think if I was gonna write a list of the characters that I thought that I liked the most in this movie, it would probably be number one, New York. Number two, Sybil Shepherd's character.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, number three, that saxophone that keeps following Robert De Niro around. probably way at the bottom of the list, the actual main character, which might not have been unintentional on the part of filmmakers.
Yeah, so do you think that was intentional to make him the least likable character in the piece?
I don't know. And to a certain degree, I guess it doesn't necessarily worry me because this film's been out for decades, but it's like to some people, like to me, as I was watching this, I was like, okay, as I was watching this movie, when you're talking about this character, I was like, why am I seeing a movie from the point of view of the poorly written antagonist of a Hollywood detective movie?
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's like, the movie starts when a politician gets killed. The actual protagonist finds out it was Robert De Niro's character, messed up Vietnam War veteran with shell shock, who thought he was living some kind of weird delusion, right? Without too much else floating around the character. As I was watching this, I was like, I would almost rather see this movie from anybody else's point of view than this character. I think for a lot of other people, they see this character and they say, that guy is awesome. All of these individual things that this guy is doing are awesome. Like the gun buying and the shooting and the getting into a shootout in a brothel, kind of, or just like a seedy hotel where this stuff goes on. And he kind of saves a prostitute. So yay. There's a lot of this stuff going on that kind of, as an isolated thing, might be cool, might be interesting, but when you put it all together, it kind of makes this picture of this character who is just a very sad and not someone that I would relate to in any way.
Oh, I totally agree with you on that, because
it's kind of by the end of the discussion we had with Raging Bull.
Mm-hmm.
When we got into Raging Bull, and you know, that came later, but it's the same kind of group here. They weren't afraid to show a main character. No, granted, in that case, a real person, but they weren't afraid to have the main character be so flawed that he wasn't necessarily a traditional protagonist. He was a character. These things he did, these things happened to him. This was his reality. And I kind of felt like here, I didn't associate myself or even really empathize with Travis Bickle, but he was kind of fascinating nonetheless, in the same way, you know, you stare at a bug, where you have that moment of, this is a terrible person, but what's he really doing? He's trying desperately to connect to somebody. He lives in his shabby little room and he rides around 12 hours a night in a car with strangers for an hour at a time. And then he falls in love with the most beautiful woman in the world, circa 1976. And that goes badly because he's so bad at it. And then he finds this little girl that he wants to save, and that goes badly because he's so bad at it. And Harvey Keitel is there for some reason, and that goes really badly. And it just comes to a point where I don't like him. I don't want to like him. I don't feel like he's my hero. But as a point of view character, God, it's fascinating.
Well, and I think it's fascinating because you are kind of inside the mind of a killer tonight.
Sure.
On PBS. But it's also, I think, fascinating because you're seeing these signs of what is tearing this character down. What are all the things that he's just either mentally unable to do, and he doesn't seem like a stupid person. He seems very intelligent, especially with the ability to build the sleeve gun that pops out. That kind of took me out of the story a little bit, because I'm like, wait a minute, he's not smart enough to do that. And then I had to rethink that, yeah, he actually is a lot smarter. But his upbringing, you know, there's something in his past that we don't know about. And I don't think it's all Vietnam. I think religion plays a big role in his upbringing. Mm-hmm. And I think the war and being told what to do, and as you said, Matthew, just simply not being able to connect with people again and again and again, just finally boils to a head. And when he gets to the point where he is just like, you know what, I am an utter failure, and he goes off to do this stuff with Iris and basically tells her, hey, by the time you get this money, I'm going to be dead. And of course, he wants to go and kill a presidential candidate, which he can't even get that right. And I think he goes into the brothel with the expectation that no matter what, he's going to die at the end.
Well,
he even tries to kill. He tries to kill himself and evens out of bullets. He can't even do suicide right. And then in a weird, ironic twist of fate, he becomes a hero.
Yeah. Which sort of. It plays into the kind of darkness that you talked about, how the city was horrible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they said he was a hero, but really all he did was go in cold blood murder a bunch of people.
Well, but he took on the mafia.
But
and,
he murdered
and, yeah.
bad people.
Murdered bad people. Murdered, that makes him the hero. Let's take this from Rodrigo's standpoint of, you know, the protagonist comes on board, finds out there's this murder plot, and has to go hunt down the antagonist. Maybe this is the story of, here's a vigilante a la Charles Bronson, who's going around taking the law into his own hands, we see Travis Bickle as a hero. Let's say we pick up this story as him as the hero, and everybody's lauding him for, you know, taking on the bad guy and doing stuff the city won't do. And then we find out that the only reason he's considered a hero is because he's such a screw up at everything else, and he's really a psychotic person. You know, that makes the story radically different if you look at it from that point.
I think it does, but I think as it as the story unfolds and the order that the story unfolds, it was very surprising to me that the movie didn't end with him putting a finger to his head and pretending like he's pulling a trigger.
Absolutely.
And that we turn around and like later on he becomes this heroic figure, because it's like the movie didn't do enough to tell us that this was ironic.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's like as I was watching this movie, I was like, am I supposed to like this character?
Yeah.
And it never really, the movie never really makes up his mind. So like if the movie was like, here's this terrible person, and in the end he accidentally becomes a hero because of his craziness, that would be one thing. If it's like, this guy has always secretly been a hero, he's just confused, but at the end he manages to do it, that would be another. But this movie is like everything. It's, this guy is sometimes okay. He's also completely crazy. He's trying to save this prostitute. Also murder this politician for no apparent reason.
Tried to, yeah.
He's just
he was trying to set the woman free.
I guess.
I think that was his whole thing, was to set
Sybil Shepherd's.
Yeah, her free.
Sybil Shepherd.
And to let both of the females reach the full potential that he thought was possible to them, because he thought they were succumbing to a lesser life than what he thought was possible.
Mm-hmm. Now there's the ending where he turns out to be the hero. Has a little bit of weird interpretation on it as well, Zach.
Yeah, I was reading, which I think puts the whole thing in a different light, but I kind of like that Roger Ebert proposed in his review of the film that everything after Travis putting his finger to his head is his final thoughts before he died there in that room, and that he gets to be the hero that he wanted to be, and that none of that actually happened, but it was all inside of his mind. And he actually another theory was that the scene where he's taking the guy in the taxi ride, where he ends up saying he's going to kill his wife and the guy she's with, that was also a manifestation of Travis's own mind.
Oh, so the guy wasn't.
That's so what some people think. The guy in the
cab is Martin Scorsese. Did you know that?
Oh,
the guy that said, I'm going to go up there and kill my wife. Yeah. That's Martin Scorsese.
Because he talks in a very specific manner.
Last week we were talking about directors injecting themselves into a film. Last week with Rebel Without a Cause, it's just this walking through the scene at the end. Mm-hmm. Here, Martin Scorsese really becomes a character in the movie that is one of the tipping points for Travis to just say, you know what? I'm going to go buy guns. I'm going to start killing people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the dream sequence, Matthew, does that, it all being a fantasy, does that change the perspective of the story for you if that were really the case, if it were all a dream sequence?
Absolutely. And the reason I say that is because on my first pass through, first time I ever saw this movie, that's what I thought. That is what I thought, because you get to the point where terrible things are happening and you have that incredibly, you know, especially for 1976, incredibly graphic sequence with the shooting and the blood and the Glaven and the Feundleben. And then you cut to a happy ending and you have this thing of, you know, Iris gets her happy ending. And Travis is a hero, and he gets to tie things up at the end with Betsy in a very kind of ethereal and strange moment, because, you know, he's standing there and somebody's like, oh, you got a passenger in your cab. And he wanders over and gets in the cab. And then after a few seconds, she says, hi, Travis. It all feels weird and disconnected and fantasy. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's what, I think Scorsese has said that's not what he intended.
Right.
But that was my thought process the first time I saw it. And today, rewatching it, knowing that that's not what necessarily they intended, it still feels like it kind of changes everything about the end of that movie.
I think there's a reason why that's a popular view, is because as you're watching this, you think to yourself, no, this guy shouldn't have a happy ending.
Yeah.
Like for and I think for two reasons. One, and you may subscribe to that for one of the two reasons or both. One, he's not a good guy. It's like his motivation is either very unclear or very negative, right? He wants to kind of control these women, and therefore he resorts to violence to do it. Even if like it is to set them free, they're not asking him to set them free. He goes and does it against their will, right? So that's one. And the other one is like, you're watching this super gritty movie, and it's like all of a sudden there's a happy ending, like physically gritty. You see like how grimy and awful New York is, and then you see all this crime and all this blood and all this violence, and there's a happy ending. And I think to a certain degree, just because just thematically, you might feel cheated. Like even if this guy was a good guy, you would kind of expect out of this movie for him to die a horrible death, for the city to crush him. And it doesn't. It's like hilariously, in our own minds, we construct this fiction in which this guy didn't get to be a hero.
And here's my problem with this, because at the very end, we start doing this crane up shot of the crime scene, right? And typically in film, that is your indication that the story is over,
right?
And so.
Yeah.
The first time that I saw this movie and we get to that happy ending, I'm like, WTF. Although I think back in whenever I saw this movie in the 80s, 90s, whatever it was, I don't think WTF had been invented yet. No. But, you know, it's just basically like,
gag me with a spoon.
Gag me with a spoon. Yes, there you go.
Hoser.
Because it just feels so completely out of place. And it's almost feel offended. First time I saw this, very offended by how that ending was just felt tacked on, like, you know, if we don't do something, we're going to have an X rating on this film and we'll never be able to show it to anybody.
There's a third. That's interesting because, there's a third reason to kind of reject that ending and think of it as a fantasy. And that is a filmmaker reason. So not just a character and theme reason, but a filmmaker reason, in that all of the visual cues of photography, of filmmaking, tell you that the story is over.
Right.
Yeah. Giant crane shot, completely, like, all sound suppressed except for the score, slow-moving shot from above. Like, everything tells you this movie is over, and then it keeps going. Weirdly, it's a violation of the language of film.
So in a sense, with Travis Bickle being a person who just violates society and societal norms, here Scorsese is violating the viewer with breaking of convention. And I don't know, that ending just feels tacked on. Like, again, it was a response to, and this movie did almost get a higher than an R rating, which in the 1970s would have been an X rating. Just because of the violence,
like 10 minutes.
Well, yes, among other things, but yes, literally the last 30 minutes of the film.
The violence of that gunfight was just unheard of, and outside of a Sam Peckinpah movie in 1976, that didn't happen.
Yeah, when was Dog Day
Afternoon? But I think that Dog Day Afternoon was 74, I want to say. But you can go back to the Wild Bunch in 69 and you can see some serious. Yeah. But I think when you really look at it, what it breaks down to for me, I don't want to say tacked on, because there is a very, very important character bit at the very end of that stuff. If you take it as actually happening and Travis recovering and all of the things, and you get to the end when he's driving away, he's dropped off Betsy. He's sitting there in his car. He's driving. He's kind of got his closure. And then there's that scare cord. He kind of glances something out of the corner of his eye, and then he comes back. And there's that moment of, he's still dangerous. he's still ready to explode. Something is going, you know, something will eventually set this man off again.
Yeah, and I think that's I think that was the main interpretation that Scorsese and the writer of the movie, Paul Schrader, both intended, was that everything turned out okay this time, but he's still charged up and he's still going to kill again.
That little bit right at the very end before the credits started rolling, just because I'd kind of checked out. I was like, okay, this weird ending is over. Drop the girl off. He's driving away. Blah 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 blah. And it's like, rant. And you're like, whoa. And then I had to like rewind it and watch it again. Yep.
So
again, undermining your expectations with that ending, and then undermining it again with the that moment. I think if you take it as a whole, you can see as it does kind of fit with this movie not having a conventional movie narrative and having that weird, off-putting central theme and central character. I mean, you get to the end and it ends in a way that leaves us frustrated and angry. And that kind of makes sense because that makes us feel like Travis Bickle throughout the whole film.
It may be
brilliance.
If you go and look at a lot of the movies that are coming out in the early 70s, you know, you look at Dog Day Afternoon, you look at The Wild Bunch, which was really late 60s. But you look at movies like Taxi Driver, you look at movies in this vein, and they are very depressing movies. We talk on another one of our podcasts, the Major Spoilers podcast, how in the 80s, Frank Miller's Dark Knight turned comic books into very dark and gritty and turned all the characters into dark, gritty characters. Vietnam is an event that changed America and really is reflected in the movies of this time period. And so you look at, when was Deliverance? When did that come out? Deliverance came out in 72. You know, you look at all these movies and
Midnight
they are
Cowboy in 69. Mm-hmm,
they are a reflection of this, I don't want to say dystopian viewpoint of the future, but everyone's frustration and disappointment of everything that's going on with Vietnam and the country and the gas crisis and all these world events that are just doom and gloom even before, you know, the Cold War hit its peak in the 80s. And what's fascinating,
Jimmy Carter's creeping malaise.
Yes. You know, when Nixon is about ready to resign, you know, at this time, you've got Watergate going on. Just nothing interest. I mean, I shouldn't say nothing interesting. Nothing positive appears to be going on. And you see that in these movies. This is really interesting because you hit Star Wars and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which are just literally a year away. And I point to movies like Taxi Driver, Deliverance, Midnight Cowboy, MASH, even though that's satirical. But as this way of lifting people out of their malaise.
The theme song from MASH is called Suicide is Painless.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so Star Wars, I think, was successful because it was totally different from every other film that was being made at this time. Because it was true escapism. This was more of a, let's hold a mirror up to what we're doing to war vets. What are we doing to society? You know, what's going on? And I think that's why Star Wars has become so popular at this time, because nobody was expecting it at the time. Nobody was expecting Go ahead.
Oh, it was that. It's that mark of that next generation, right? So Lucas and Spielberg are younger filmmakers who are kind of going into that big spectacle movie instead of showing that they're not turning a mirror on the human condition. They are almost pretty much 100% entertainers. They are creating this movie for you to look at and be excited about and happy and sad and crazy times, as opposed to turning a microscope onto New York City.
So you like this story, Zach, from the story perspective? I mean, we've got a few technical things to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah, I actually did like the story.
Okay.
I thought it was compelling, and I mean, for more reasons than the technical side that we can get into why I thought the story was good. But before we get into technical stuff, let's give some shout out to our associate producers. They are Bao King, Nicole Gross, Justin Norris, Fabian Cune, David Marbell, Nathan Olson, Simley Chuan, Aaron Mattner, Sean Ingard, Seamus Dorr, Joseph Smith, Adrian Watson, Alistair Shields, Cara Mosier, Brian Nelson. Thank you, one and all, for supporting Zach on Film and all the other great Major Spoilers podcasts.
And this is where we break in with our little, for only 25 cents a day, you can help young Zach learn to read.
Names? Exactly. That's pretty good.
Learn to pronounce Seamus.
Seamus
is a tough one.
Yeah. That's okay.
Yeah.
So this movie
got Simley Chuan dead down, so I'm happy with that.
Bam.
So this movie was so violent.
And now Simley Chuan is going to tell us we pronounced it wrong.
No, this movie was so violent. It really was borderline. We're going to give you an X rating on this. And what we see happening is they actually went in and desaturated that last part of the movie where the blood and violence take place to tone down the bright red look of the blood that was splattering on all the walls and the people and everything in there. And I think, you know, Scorsese goes in and says later, he goes, you know, I'm really glad we had to desaturate it because I think it made it look more gritty and more realistic. And I think if you watch, I don't know, I've been playing Dead Rising on Xbox One, whatever it is, version 4, the fourth version of that. And the blood and the violence is all dark. I mean, dark red blood running everywhere. Granted, everybody's dead, so maybe it is supposed to be that way. But from an aesthetic standpoint, if that had been bright, you know, cherry red blood that you see in other movies, I don't think that scene would not have been as intense as it was. Even though, I mean...
No.
The exploding hand sequence could have turned very, very, you know, over the top. It could have been very, very Muppets Take Manhattan. And I think one of the things that helped to sell it was the fact that the blood was not incredibly red. And it was kind of a gross moment when you couldn't tell if it was blood or skin or whatever that hit Travis.
Mm-hmm.
It really sold that moment and kept it from being something that was almost, it could have been goofy seeing someone's entire hand explode from a 44 Magnum round.
What were you going to say, Rodrigo?
What was I going to say?
Something about blood and violence.
I think that, it's interesting. How things like that sometimes end up working for the movie, right? They desaturate the scene. And I remember thinking, seeing the blood and thinking, wow, this actually probably looks like actual blood.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Maybe back in the 70s, it's like when you see a lot of the time when you see like old movies from the 60s and 70s and they fire a gun, it sounds like a pop cap. You know, it sounds like pew, pew, pew.
Yeah.
It's like, but that's a little bit closer to what actual guns sound like. Like they, you know, actual guns supposedly, you know, what they always tell you is they sound like firecrackers, you know, from if you're not like right up next to it being shot. So it doesn't have like, you can't always hear that like huge timbre that they add to the gun.
Yeah.
So, you know, same deal with this blood. I was like, oh, that's interesting. And it's interesting to hear that they desaturated it because they thought it was too violent and thus made it more realistic. I mean, we've heard of times when they're like, oh, no, take out this scene or take out like somebody actually getting hurt or whatever. But it ends up being more terrifying because then it leaves it up to your imagination.
Yeah. Right.
So it's interesting to see moments in which censorship actually ends up working for the movie. And I think that scene was definitely one of them.
That scene is definitely more effective because of that choice.
What do you think of the choice of Harvey Keitel as the pimp? Man, that is a surprise. If you don't know Harvey, if you don't know Harvey Keitel's in the movie, you're going to go, holy crap, that's Harvey Keitel.
Yeah.
Clearly, Scorsese didn't realize that Harvey Keitel has always been a weird 50-year-old man.
That's exactly what I was thinking during this.
When he cast him as an 18-year-old pimp, like something must have happened. He must have been like bribed or something that he didn't realize that he was casting somebody who was secretly always a 50-year-old weird guy.
Well, the thing that's really fascinating about this is Harvey Keitel was not quite 40 when this movie was filmed. But if you look at the sequences, especially his long thing where he's talking to Iris and telling her how wonderful she is. Every character choice he makes is designed to make my skin crawl. From his hairstyle to the way he talks to just the way he looks at everyone, you want Travis Bickle to shoot this man.
Yeah.
You want him to shoot him more than he does.
Yeah, it was kind of a surprise when he does pull that gun out and shoots him in the gut. Yeah. This movie has a lot of really, great actors. I mean, you got Albert Brooks, Cybill Shepherd.
Which that was weird.
Seeing him in there because he's normally
I'd never
comedian.
Seen him like that before.
Yeah. Peter Boyle, who I just love.
He's amazing.
Hair.
Yeah.
Frankenstein's creation.
Yes. And the father on, most people I think would know him from Raymond. The father on Raymond. Everybody Loves Raymond.
Everybody loves.
Of course, you got Robert De Niro, and then you've got Jodie Foster, 13 years old when they did this movie with her. And in this final scene where everything just goes to hell, people were concerned that, oh my God, this trauma that you're putting this child through. And Jodie Foster really thought it was kind of neat because she got to see all this behind the scenes stuff, and they walked her through it and showed her how the squibs worked and all those kinds of things. Wasn't really very traumatic for her. She thought it was a lot of fun. And I think she did a good job playing an age, 12-year-old prostitute.
Yeah, I think one of the best moments for me for her character was when she's in the diner with Travis and she's wearing those crazy green sunglasses. And then she takes them off and puts on a completely different pair of glasses. Like, that is what preteen girls do.
Oh.
All the time.
Yeah.
There are amazing character moments, none of which involve the main character. The discussion between Cybill Shepherd's character and that guy that's helping her with the campaign. It's amazing. Like, I wanted to just see that movie.
Yeah.
I wanted to see the movie where it's just like, look outside. I don't see anything. Put your glasses on. Okay. All right. It's like, shut again. Yes. Oh, yeah,
Albert
I see
Brooks
him now.
Is awesome.
Like,
yeah.
It's just like so dry.
Albert Brooks is amazing.
It's just really amazing.
I've seen this movie
the same thing
times.
With the same thing with Jodie Foster's character. Like, anytime she's on screen, there's something about her that's like really like electric.
Oh my God, yes. And can we talk about how incredibly beautiful Cybill Shepherd is in this movie?
Oh man, she is great.
I mean, she is my God, it's like you see the moment, and the first we see her, Travis is railing on and on about how she's so perfect and angelic and beautiful. And for one of the first times in movie watching, a character telling me that a character was incredibly gorgeous sold it, with Cybill Shepherd walking into screen and they had a little bit of the slow-mo. She was wearing the white dress and none of them could touch her. And I'm like, oh my God. I died every time she looked at the camera when she was doing the reaction shots. I was just like, I can't believe that's the same actress that I watched on that sitcom in the 90s.
Yeah,
because holy crap.
I'm disappointed we didn't get to see more of her character and her interactions in that. But a fantastic job. Now, there is a dark side to this movie beyond the dark themes and everything. And that is the assassination attempt of Ronald Reagan in the 80s, in 81, when he was attacked.
Yep, 1981.
John Hinckley Jr. became obsessed with Jodie Foster in this role and obsessed with the idea of Taxi Driver and everything that was going in it. And he claims, the defense claims, whatever, that it was the movie that caused him to go and try to assassinate the president, just like in the movie Travis goes and tries to assassinate George Wallace,
presidential
candidate. So I think that's kind of really crazy. I think that was the first time I'd ever heard of Taxi Driver, was when suddenly it came out about the Jodie Foster connection and Taxi Driver. I'm like, well, what's this Taxi Driver movie? I don't think I ever want to see it. And then it was in the middle, early 90s when I finally did watch it.
And that and the You Talking to Me reason why the general public knows this movie. And it really kind of is depressing having seen it again. And, this again is, I think, either my third or fourth time seeing this movie. And it was like a whole new movie to me. It's been, when were we in college? It's been probably 20 years
Early
since
90s.
I've seen this.
Yeah.
But I don't remember Albert Brooks.
Yeah.
I don't remember some of the wonderful conversations with the wizard in the automat. A lot of these things didn't stick with me. But when I sat down and I watched it today, I mean, this is a powerful movie. This is a movie that I am certainly not going to demean anybody's insanity, but you can kind of see why it wasn't, you know, The Adventures of Ford Fairlane that sent somebody over the edge. This is a movie that affects you, even if you are, you know, fully in control of your capacity.
Well, and let's go back to what Rodrigo was saying.
I think it's kind of
saying.
A shame that people associate that.
Well, and that's what I was saying. Go back to what Rodrigo was saying earlier. When you've got a movie like this, or American Psycho, or Natural Born Killers, or gosh, what's a more recent version of this where we're introduced to the psychotic killer?
Saw.
Maybe not. Probably not.
Well,
Saw.
As a protagonist, though.
But from the protagonist standpoint.
Saw
so when we look at Travis Bickle, I mean, people with
falling
John
down.
Hinckley Jr. falling
there
down. People with John Hinckley Jr. type problems. Travis Bickle type problems are going to identify with this mm-hmm. character and say, oh, well, that's what he would do. I'll go do that too. So, I mean, there are
some. The important thing there is the, that pre-existing thing, right? It's
right.
Not, the movie doesn't mm-hmm. make you.
No,
like
no, no,
this,
no, 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 no.
Right?
Certainly not.
Yeah, we've got a big lag this week on the show, and I don't know why. I just checked my internet speed. The internet speed is fine, but we've got some real lag issues this week with the stupid Skype.
Stupid Skype.
I think we need to install ISDN lines at everybody's house.
I think we've got some lag issues this week, Stephen.
Really? Wow. Okay. We'll try to address those. God. So this was named in 1994, a movie that the Library of Congress considered culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant, and it has to be preserved. Although, going back to the extreme violent scenes, apparently they cannot find any of the original shot footage that hasn't been desaturated.
The color footage?
Yeah, so nobody can find that anymore.
Which is kind of darn.
Yeah, which a lot of people point to as a shame. So, Zach, what kind of things did you learn from the movie? And you and I had a conversation on whether the fiance was watching it. I'd be interested to see if she actually did or not.
I'll answer that right now, and that's no. I said, hey, I have to watch this tonight. You want to watch it with me? She said, well, I said, I have to watch movie tonight. What do you want to watch? She asked, what are you watching? I said, Taxi Driver. She said, she Googled it. She said, that looks old and boring.
Well, at least you didn't. What was the one with Queen Latifah?
Tell her you're old and boring.
What's the taxi movie with Queen Latifah? Is it just called Taxi?
Taxi.
So, yeah, something like that.
Yes.
Yeah. Just tell her that you can make it up to her by watching Frozen, which is now available on iTunes.
Oh, she loves Frozen.
See, you can make it up to her. You watch my movie, and then we'll watch your movie.
Yeah. No, it's already passed.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Okay, so takeaways.
So what I learned, I really dug a lot of the early sequences when Travis is driving around town, and the way they show the monotony of his job through... There's that just that one quick section where they showed the same stoplight.
Yeah, yeah.
They show it like once, twice, and just keep speeding up, showing him how it just goes on and on forever, and how there. I know there's a time length in this movie. There's a significant time chunk, I think.
Sure.
And it's not. I mean, he says it in his journal diaries. What date it is? I didn't pay attention close enough, but I realized that. The way that they structure what they show his day on how long and just boring, and he just does the same thing over and over and over again, that they didn't need to show it a lot, that it's just implied through the editing and the cinematography that this is what he does every day. There's nothing really different, and it just goes on from this point, from this month to this next month when something significant happens. And so that was... a nice way of showing passage of time besides just showing that kind of old way of the pages on the calendar falling away or the clock going mm-hmm. really fast.
I think his hairstyle, because it changed enough in the time, also gave you that indication.
Yeah, it did a little bit
pretty well. So,
especially when he like buzzed it.
Yeah. That was a hairpiece, actually.
Oh, was
although
it?
If he would have really done it, it would have been really impressive.
It wouldn't have. Well, thinking about it, because what he did for Raging Bull mm-hmm. to put on much weight and lose all the weight, and you think he Yeah, I saw him. He bulked up on in this movie, so it wouldn't have surprised me if he wouldn't have.
Yeah, I would have thought so. I would have thought so too. But I was doing some research, and I came across these images of all the hair pieces from the film. So I just assume that it's hair piece. So
cool.
Matthew, I'm going to give it to you this week to close out and give us your assessment of Zach's assessment, and then we'll get out of here.
I believe that Zach actually did pretty well this week. I think that the main themes of this are off-putting and disturbing enough that it would be easy to disconnect, to soft pedal, to, you know, back away from it. And it really felt like Zach was totally into it. Plus, he agrees with me that Cybill Shepherd is hotter than donut grease. So I'm going to give him a B+ this time around. Definitely some solid work. I would say one thing I would like in, you know, the next time we have a movie from the 70s, we need to talk about music in the 70s. Because dang.
Well, you're in luck, Matthew, because next week we will be taking a look at 1974's The Conversation, which if you haven't seen that, oh my goodness, that is a great movie.
Is it musical?
There is music in it.
I've never seen that.
It's got Gene Hackman in it as well.
Cool.
I guess one thing I would add on, it's also got Cindy Williams in it as a in a part, Terry Garr, Harrison Ford, all these people play in this movie. One thing I would say, Zach, I think. Don't just watch the movies that we've been talking about on the show once. I think you need to revisit them multiple times.
Before we talk about
them? No, not before we talk about them. But now you've got a perspective. Now go back and watch it again in 2 years or 3 years or whatever it is and see if you've got a better perspective on it. I think the last time I watched The Conversation was about a year and a half ago. I'm ready to watch it again just to get a different perspective.
Mm-hmm. Which is good because we have to.
Yeah.
For next week, Zach
so
on film.
That is it for this week on Zach on Film. Make sure to head over to majorspoilers.com.
I think there's some delay this week.
Podcast posting page where you can give your thoughts on Taxi Driver and everything that happened in this episode. While you're on majorspoilers.com, make sure to click on the amazon.com link where you can go buy your very own copy of Taxi Driver, or, you know, like a TV or a Blu-ray player or a cool Apple TV. And none of that will cost you any extra. But a little bit, we'll come back to Major Spoilers to keep our ship afloat. So next week, we're going to be talking The Conversation for Zach on Film.